All right, welcome to Active Heart, episode 2.
Hey, everyone.
So we just finished watching episode 2, and now we're going to talk about it.
For the second time.
Yes, we watched this one twice. We watched it last night and didn't record, and to refresh our minds, we watched it again this morning. So we're all refreshed. So this one starts off with a flashback to the event, the encounter that killed Noriko's father.
In 2015,
which I think we incorrectly stated last episode that it was happening in 2015.
Yeah.
But that was wrong. And the contemporaneous events, or rather the contemporary events in Gunbuster are happening in 2023?
Yes.
Okay. Anyhow, so 2015, Noriko's dad is the captain of a ship that is destroyed by the space monsters, and we see that encounter and see furthermore the encounter that left Coach the sole survivor of the Luxion.
And it's actually that Admiral Takaya saved his life.
TK, buddy. All right.
Our cat is messing around.
Yeah, he's doing a lot. All right. Yes. And one of the things, I mean, this is total trivia, but one of the things that immediately jumped out to me is there's a caption that comes up to situate the viewers, like, that this is a flashback and this is the Luxion, and it gives the location as like 12,000 parsecs or something from Earth. And I love that it uses parsec correctly. Famously in Star Wars, the parsec is implied to be a unit of time, parsec meaning being short for parallax second, but parsec is actually a unit of distance used by astronomers to make convenient distance calculations. And it's complicated to explain what it actually is. I had to look it up on Wikipedia, and I understand it, but I can't explain it on a podcast. But it has to do with geometry. But it has to do with calculating one way that astronomers calculate how far away something is from us is how it appears to shift relative to objects behind it as the Earth goes around in its orbit around the sun. So parallax, and that effect is called parallax. The most famous way people know about parallax, or the most common way people know about parallax, is that one of the big innovations in console video games in the jump from the 8-bit generation to the first 16-bit generation was that the newer hardware allowed for parallax scrolling, which is like in a platformer, you could have a background that scrolled by at a slower speed than the foreground, giving the illusion of objects that were in the background. So like Super Mario World, Sonic the Hedgehog, these were some of the first games to have parallax scrolling, and it was a big deal at the time. So that's what parallax is, and a parsec is a parallax second, and it's about 3 light years in terms of distance. So the Luxion 12,000 parsecs, so like, you know, 40,000 or so light years out. It's way out there.
When I was in college, I wrote a paper that was called Metaphorical Parallax, --.
Nice.
But it was an art history paper, so it was about how we understand this particular work of art in a really psychosexual post-Freudian light, but that people looking at this art at the time when it was made, that wouldn't have even occurred to them.
Mm.
So I just make I make scientific things unscientific. But anyway. Also, it was interesting to me that Coach like it appears that he lost his eye before this space battle. Like he already has a
right. His eye is already scarred. Like we assumed that it was scarred from that encounter, but no, he's already got a badass scar. Another thing that I noticed is that the Luxion's name on the side of the ship is given in hiragana, which is interesting. So Japanese has three writing conventions that are all used simultaneously in written Japanese, and one of them, two of them are phonetic, and one of them is ideographic, like Chinese characters. And the two phonetic systems are called hiragana and katakana, and they are used respectively, typically for native Japanese words and loan words. Luxion is obviously not a native Japanese word, but it's written using the syllabary that would be more commonly used for a native Japanese word. And it gives it a kind of sort of old-fashioned, for lack of a better term, sense to see it painted that way on the side of the ship. And it's just a little detail that stuck out to me.
Yeah.
And in general, I love the warships. The warships in Gunbuster are very, like, old-fashioned rocket ships looking, and it's kind of charming.
And Admiral Takaya, like, at the moment of his death, he's watching a video of Noriko as a child.
Yes,
like
he pulls out his little...
Her last... transmission.
Yeah, he pulls out a little tablet and watches a vine of his daughter.
I guess since that was 2015, vines still exist.
Yeah, maybe did was it 2014 or 20? It could have been a vine.
2016
could have been a vine. It's not actually a tablet. I got the sense that it was a purpose-built like animated picture frame.
Yeah,
that like plays a little animation when you push the button. And it's funny because such things actually do exist now. I thought it was a neat little anticipation of the kind of technology that would exist at the time. We do have animated picture frames. We don't have faster than light travel.
But maybe we will in
2023. Maybe, but we already, by Gunbuster timeline, we should have already had it.
That's true.
Anyhow, so this is sort of an important establishing scene. And then that scene ends and we find ourselves on the space plane, on the JAL space plane with Noriko and Kazumi approaching the site for the next step of their training.
Which is not the ship that they're going to spend most of their time on.
No.
The ship that they're going to be fighting with the base of is the Excelion, which is under construction. So they go to a space station called the Silver Star.
Right.
And the Excelion is not going to be completed for another like 6 or 7 months.
And it's there that they meet Young Freud.
My rapper name.
Young Freud is a great character and is funny for a variety of reasons. The first of all being, firstly, that she's supposed to be a Russian.
The Soviets?
Yes.
But yes, she's from
Soviets.
She's a Soviet Union pilot.
Right, but why is her name two German people?
Because Hideaki Anno made it.
Yeah, no, it's great. But she's a Soviet pilot, and her uniform and mech is like, you know, red, and it has like the hammer and sickle all over it. And it's very funny that it dates, like that little detail dates this more than many other things do.
Because the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991. But they wouldn't have known that.
Right, which was like just a couple of years after this was made. But in 1988, it still seemed pretty established. So, and Young Freud is like sort of the other ace. And she and Kazumi immediately identify each other as like rivals.
Yeah. Which I really loved. because it's like it's a new side of Amano.
Yeah, we've never seen her. We've never seen her feel like seriously challenged by anybody before.
But she's, I mean, she's on an equal level of sort of directness and badassery as Young. And it's clear that when she's put in a situation where she doesn't have to be like the perfect princess,
yeah,
she has no trouble being assertive with people.
Yeah,
she just doesn't like, she doesn't want to waste her time on people that aren't gonna see her seriously.
Yeah, yeah,
she
yeah.
Is. And once she identifies that, she is very competitive and very driven.
Right.
And
you know, despite the fact that we, you get a sense that she's pretty. You know, I take it back. Like, I have in my mind this image of Amano as kind of by the books, but I don't think she actually is. Like, in the first episode, she had no trouble essentially going to Coach and complaining to him about, or like disputing his decision to him, as opposed to just accepting the chain of command. And in this episode, when they go out for their first training sortie and Young Freud immediately challenges her to a duel, like going AWOL, Amano is like, great, yes, let's settle this right now.
Yeah.
And Noriko's like, guys, I don't think we should be doing this. And Amano and Young Freud ignore her completely and like immediately jet off to go have a mech duel.
Yeah.
To settle which one of them is really the better.
And it's at the end of the first episode, we had a mech duel.
Yeah, although it was a lot shorter.
This is so much more high stakes and real. And like, Young is, she kind of has the like narrowed eyes of the head bully, but is so much more of a real version.
Well, it feels like
aggressive genius pilot is.
But this doesn't feel like bullying.
No, I don't think she's a bully.
It's not bullying at all. It's like she can't resist a challenge, and she also wants to establish a pecking order, I think.
Yeah, what I mean is that it sort of casts the schoolyard duel as the kind of just dumb childishness that it was.
Right. It's like this is actually a serious fight. And it goes on for like, it's an extended battle sequence as they fight. They jet off away from the Silver Star and wind up fighting in the superstructure of the under construction Excelion. And it's a pretty thrilling sequence. And it's the first time we've seen two like really confident, really skilled pilots pushing each other, and it sort of culminates with Amano doing the lightning reversal kick and Young Freud just blocks it.
And right before that, there was a moment that reminded me of like an old samurai movie.
Okay.
Young is observing Amano's mech, and I don't remember what the words are, but it's like, this stance with no openings. Like, yes. It's very like, you've watched old samurai movies where half of the battle is like them narrating at each other that they understand.
I mean, I don't know much about like samurai cinema. I've seen like certainly like kung fu movies where there's lots of like, I see you're using the blank style or whatever. It definitely feels like drawing on that martial arts tradition of, I can see that they're not using, you know, they're using this stance and there's no openings, but I'll make one, says Young Freud. And they seem to be basically evenly matched, and the battle is not resolved.
No.
Neither of them comes away a clear winner, because it ends when they accidentally stumble upon, in the superstructure of the Excelion, a like preserved space monster corpse.
Yeah. It's very creepy.
Yeah, it's this giant
Amano basically backs into it.
Yeah, and it's this giant insectoid thing. Like, it's many times larger than the mechs that they're in. And it's this big sort of almost Lovecraftian, like like insectoid monster, and Noriko immediately has a breakdown when she sees the like the true face of her enemy for the first time and realizes that her father died because of this creature, this horrific thing.
Yeah. When they show the whole corpse, there's this really dramatic pan up.
Yeah.
And it once again made me think of Eva.
Right.
It's like they show the space monster more the way that Eva showed the Eva. It's like full form for the first time.
Oh, interesting. Oh, I just want to back up for 1 second. I love that Amano, or not Amano, Young Freud says something during their fight, says something to Kazumi being like, I would expect nothing less from the Rose Queen. It's like, this is the first time it has been suggested that Kazumi has the nickname, has a nickname, and that nickname is Rose Queen.
Yeah.
But apparently she does. Which and then Amano is like, every rose has its thorns.
That was... Yeah.
It's very good. But anyway, yes, they see their enemy for the first time. It reminded, like, I was thinking too of Eva and comparing the space monsters to the
angels
as being, and they function similarly in both shows, and in that, like, they're this completely incomprehensible, completely implacable enemy. Like, the motivation, I remember the first time I watched Eva as a young idiot, I was very frustrated by it never being made clear, like, what the angels...
Young idiot with a J.
Yes, that was me. It was made... I was very frustrated by how it was never made clear what the angels', like, motivation were. Like, what were they? And it's like, it doesn't matter, dude. They're giant monsters that are trying to destroy humanity. And the space monsters in Gunbuster... which I never questioned. I don't know why. What are they? They're giant monsters who want to destroy humanity. Like, that's all they are. That's the point. The point is they're like implacable incomprehensibility. Like, you can't talk with them. You can't negotiate with them. They're just going to keep coming. So
yeah,
that's another parallel, which I have come to appreciate. And like, what do you do in the face of an enemy whose motivations you truly can't comprehend, and whose, you know, overwhelming power seems solely directed at wiping you out? Like, yeah. What do you do in the face of that horror? Like, what, how do people react to that differently? And yeah, Noriko. And it's funny that I said that Noriko has, you know, in the last episode, I said Noriko seems to have basically come to terms with her father's death. If that was the case in the first episode, this episode, like, reopens all of those wounds big time.
Yeah. And up until that moment, she's pretty, like, chill.
Yeah.
Even about being there. Like, yeah. When they fly up on the plane and the Excelion comes into view for the first time, Noriko's the last one to look and get excited.
Right.
And she doesn't... It doesn't seem to dawn on her where they actually are.
Right.
And how close of a situation she could be in to that of her father's until she sees that.
Right.
Which makes... Like, who would really understand it?
Yeah, it's a very... That. I mean, it's a very, like, teenage reaction, honestly, to just sort of not taking things seriously until it's in your face, horrifyingly.
I would be like that now. But immediately after this, they are getting scolded by Coach because they broke the rules.
Yeah, they get a classic superior officer dressing down. It reminds me of every, you know, hotshot pilot getting dressed down scene in Top Gun. Every like loose cannon cop getting berated by his lieutenant. It's very tropey in that way. And but they basically get let off with a, you know, I ought to have you court-martialed, but I'm not going to.
That was a very teen moment to me, because when Coach says, but I've asked the captain to keep this quiet, both girls are like, just like have this dumb, like beaming smile.
Oh, yeah. Like, oh, good, we're not going to get in trouble.
And then I think, does Noriko speak it or does she think it? Where she's like, I wonder if Amano has ever been in trouble.
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah, that definitely comes up.
It is. I mean, it's a good question. Like, Amano definitely seems like the kind of person who just never gets in trouble. Like, she, not because she's afraid to break the rules, because clearly she's not, but rather because she's very adept at understanding and working within the power structure around her.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
You get the sense she's a person that, like, she's not a troublemaker.
No.
She saves her energy for when she wants to make any kind of bold action. And I think that emphasizes just how important and thrilling it is to her to have an equal to fight with.
Yeah.
That it would immediately just, she couldn't resist it.
Right.
And I have to, now that we're talking about her as a character, I have to go back to when she first meets Young.
Right.
And they lock eyes, and Young is like, have you even been to space before? And Amano says, yes, 3 times on vacation.
Yes.
Is that like a I'm rich bitch dig? Like,
so I wonder about that. The word that she uses in Japanese is bakansu.
Like the French word for vacation?
Yes, and I looked it up, and it's a loan word from French, from the French word meaning vacation. And I don't know whether or not it has a nuance of like being like a fancy rich people word for vacation. Like, is it the kind of thing that where like an American saying, oh, I went on holiday?
Yeah. But I feel like Americans.
But I suspect that it might. Certainly Amano has a vibe of coming from privilege.
I think an American using holiday to be kind of snobby in like a teen show has the same vibe as a Japanese teenager using a French word, especially with these shoujo tropes.
Right. I mean, it is like an actual loan word. But it might be like, that doesn't mean it doesn't have a kind of posh vibe to it. And I think it might. I can't be sure, but I think it might. And it certainly, if it does, it certainly meshes with her character to be kind of posh.
Yeah. But this would be the first case she's like lightly lorded it over anyone.
Right. She doesn't haul that out routinely.
Where after they get punished.
Yes.
The bath scene.
The bath scene. Man. Like, this has to be one of the great all-time bathing scenes in anime.
Probably.
When you talk about like gratuitous nudity.
Yeah.
Because there's like extremely gratuitous nudity throughout this scene. So it starts out with Noriko and Kazumi just hanging out, like they're bathing and talking about like, oh man, Coach really yelled at us. And we see both of them naked, and then young Freud comes in and is like, there's a certain, so speaking as someone who has been through the Japanese public bathing experience many times, there's a certain like way that you kind of carry yourself when you're in the baths that's relative, that's it's not about modesty, it's more about like sort of personal space-ness. And young Freud does not have this. She like comes into the bath and her body language is like really expansive and her big boobs are just out there.
Which is exactly what she wants.
And she's totally different.
Yeah.
Her personality during this whole conversation is like a 180 from the way it's been thus far.
She reminded me a little bit. They're completely different characters.
Yeah.
But she reminded me a little bit of my girl, Mariko, from Onisame.
Okay.
Because in Dear Brother, there's a scene where the main character, Nanako, takes a bath with her friend Mariko, who's this like eccentric, beautiful girl at their house. And young Freud in this scene is like, oh, like I love space. It makes my breasts feel lighter. But, like being in the space station, it just makes my bra tight and my back hurt. And she's kind of, she's complaining about her body, but she's also sitting in a way that's like, talk about my big breasts. Look at my big breasts.
Yeah.
Like, I have the biggest breasts here. And in the bath scene in Dear Brother, Mariko is kind of shamelessly looking in the mirror and just being like, oh, I don't like my body. I just want to be an adult already. But Nanako is like, she already looks like so much more like beautiful and adult than I do.
Right.
But it's not like Young's not, she's not mean in this scene. Like she's pretty, she does seem to genuinely be chummy.
No, I.
She just has this kind of like, I think she naturally has this like bright peacock personality.
Yeah, and she immediately just comes in and takes up all the space in the room. And I think it was interesting for a couple of reasons. One being that it establishes her as not the bully. Like, we see her being very, very challenging and confrontational up until that point. And then she comes in and is very chummy, and it doesn't feel like an act. It feels like a, yeah, I'm gonna be a rival to you, like when we're in our mechs, but we're all on the same side here, you know, and we're all girls, and, you know, I like you.
And they laugh, like they laugh at her, not in a, like in a friendly way.
Yeah, although
Amano and Noriko aren't like, ugh.
No, they're not, but they are kind of made a little bit. They find it a little bit awkward, and that's the second thing that I was going to say, which is that I think we're kind of meant to read, like, young Freud's, like, this scene to me felt like a very Japanese person's experience of being, of having a hard time anticipating the emotions of Westerners. Mm. And I, you know, I can't speak, I am not Japanese. I cannot speak for that. But so I don't say this with a lot of authority, but the framing of it as being like in a very Japanese style bath where like sort of unspoken rules and vibe is a big part of the experience. And then having this other person come in and be very kind of chatty and flaunty and in a way that neither of them would have anticipated. She's so friendly and, you know, talking about her body and all of these things. And they're not, I think they're surprised and taken aback and made a little bit uncomfortable in kind of a like cultural miscommunication way.
Yeah.
And I thought that was, it to me sort of emphasized Amano and Noriko's Japanese-ness.
Yeah.
In a way that hasn't really been highlighted before. That's and I point. that was something that I felt was notable in that scene.
Also, Young wears a big cross necklace.
That's right, she does.
And I was wondering if Misato's cross necklace
was
a throwback.
That's very interesting.
They do have one little moment of genuine like, oh, we're rivals again, and they start talking about when their birthdays are.
And oh, that's
eventually
right.
Eventually, Young goes like, "Oh, like your coach, like sure is hot. When's his birthday?" And Amano goes, "It was 2 days ago."
And that's the first time we get the sense, like, Amano's irritation seems to go to another level there.
Yeah.
And it's the first time we get a hint of Amano being a little bit possessive about Coach.
Yeah. She's a little bit possessive of everyone she cares about.
Yeah.
Noriko, too.
That's true.
Also, before we move on, it must be said that these are very good titties. Those yeah. 80s, 90s anime titty. Can't be beat.
They're pretty good.
Also, like, this is a very good example of a like a busty character who has realistically big breasts.
Mm.
And her whole, like, oh, my back hurts thing doesn't seem totally bullshit.
Mm.
For a show written and created all by men in between 25 and 30. Like, it did strike me as, obviously it's fan servicey, but it struck me as also, like, pretty real.
Okay.
And, you know, I can obviously authoritatively say that as a girl.
You can. I can't argue with that.
I can give Gynax my seal of approval.
That's right.
at least compared to most bath scenes I see in contemporary anime, where it's just immediately pings my radar of, like, this is not how girls act or talk.
I mean, but they do, like, conform to the anime trope of
girls, like, talking to each other about their breasts.
Girls in baths always talk to each other about their boobs.
I mean, the one truly ridiculous thing about this scene is that the bathhouse on the space station has, like, wall-to-wall windows. And then the male training, like, the male students and their training robots go by.
Yes, at the very end. And, like, the girls all scream and dive below the water. It also has a giant mural of, like, the Apollo moon landing. Yeah.
So we have this incredible tableau of, like, young Freud shamelessly sitting. She also, like, she's kind of like Asuka, and she, like, positions herself in a higher place than the other characters.
That's a good point. And also, in general, young Freud has, like, sort of less damaged Asuka vibes.
Which, we have this Soviet Union pilot sitting naked above the other girls against a tableau of the American moon
landing. Yeah. Well, you could spend some time on the socio-political ramifications of the framing of that scene.
Yeah. And so far, we haven't met any Americans.
No, we haven't.
So then shit gets very real.
Then shit gets extremely real, and they have to go out on their first real mission to intercept this unknown object that's approaching at high speed.
And I think, are Amano and Noriko already out on, like, a training exercise, and Coach decides to send them?
No, he decides to send them because he thinks it's important, because they're
candidates for the Gunbuster.
They're candidates for the Gunbuster project, and he wants to test them as a team.
Yeah.
He doesn't tell them that. They don't know about the Gunbuster project yet. But this is a conversation he has with the captain of the Silver Star. And I think the guy, I can't remember his name, the person...
Tatsumi something.
Tatsumi whatever is going to be the captain of the Excelion. Yeah. So anyhow, so the Coach and Amano and Noriko all go out to intercept this object that's approaching at high speed. And they get in their mechs and essentially ride these rockets.
Called Moby Dick 1 and Moby Dick 2.
Moby Dick 1 and Moby Dick 2.
And they're white.
Which are... The object is approaching at relativistic speed. And these rockets are going to accelerate them to rendezvous with it at relativistic speed. Which means that time is going to pass more quickly for the people they leave behind. They're just going to go out and back on this mission, and it's only going to take a few minutes, but months are going to pass while they're gone.
Yeah. And I think they say goodbye to young Freud right before they leave, maybe?
Yes.
There's some kind of joke, there's some sort of jokey conversation where it's just like, oh, ha ha, you're going to miss my birthday party. You're like, you're going to miss your own birthday. Don't get old.
Yeah.
And it's very, like, they're just being very blasé about time dilation.
Yeah. And I love that, it, like, at least the visually, I love that they just get on a rocket that accelerates them to near light speed. Like,
they mech jet ski
like light speed. And you know, the energy involved in accelerating like a meaningful amount of mass to relativistic speeds is like a lot. It is a lot more than like a chemical rocket could ever come up with. So it's typically when we see these kinds of scenarios, we don't like the creators, you know, they invent some kind of hand wavy, like, oh, some exotic technology that will get you going this fast. But, and I mean, clearly these are probably not chemical rockets, but it is just like a rocket shaped thing with like
handles
on. With like, you know, handles on it and like, you know, blue fire coming out the back. You know, yeah, it's probably not a chemical rocket. It's, you know, it's probably using some kind of hand wavy fusion something something, but it's still fundamentally a rocket. And I love the idea of like, we're gonna ride this rocket jet ski all the way up to light speed, baby.
It's another example of the equipment in Gunbuster having that old fashioned feel and like a heaviness, and it's very satisfying.
Yes. Like, so they get on these rockets and jet ski out to light speed and rendezvous with the object, which turns out to be Gasp, the Luxion.
The way it's revealed is, to me, another one of those brilliant,
like, visual
shots
storytelling
of animation.
Yeah, it's
like,
great.
Because they're approaching it really fast, and it kind of comes by the side.
Right.
Their rockets.
They draw alongside it, and the way it's animated is like almost like a wide angle fisheye lens view, as the letters on the side that spell out Luxion kind of wrap into view as they draw alongside it. And it's this brilliant reveal of like what it actually is.
Yeah.
So it is the ship that Noriko's father captained, and it is not a space monster. It is the ship returning to Earth. And Noriko immediately, they the mission profile, they're on a very strict timetable because every second they spend out there, weeks pass. But the mission profile goes to shit because Noriko immediately freaks out and has to get inside and see if her father is still alive. And
yeah, Amano notices that it's the Luxion first, and Coach is immediately like, you have to get
Noriko out of here.
She cannot see this. But
then
she's already jumped off her rocket and
right.
is like clawing
yeah.
the door open.
Yeah. So she claws her way in as Kazumi tries to catch up with her and get her out. And she opens the hatch and there's still air inside. And then she realizes that because the ship has been traveling at relativistic speeds. Then she looks at She looks at the ship's clock and sees that relative to ship time, only 2 days have passed since the date when it was lost. So she realizes that there could still be survivors aboard.
Yeah.
And she immediately tries to get to the bridge, which she does, but the bridge has been completely destroyed, and it's clear that her father has died.
Yeah.
And then she immediately, like, has another breakdown. And then Kazumi has to, like, rush to climb aboard and get her off. And as these scenes are cutting back and forth, one thing that I loved is that the shipboard clock is a Seiko, and the wristwatches that Amano and Coach have are Tag Heuer's. And I just love real life brands in this kind of thing. It's great.
And what I love about this immediate escalation into a very tragic situation is that it comes, you know, just a minute or two after the girls are like, ah ha ha, time dilation.
Right.
Like, our friends are just going to become old ladies.
Yeah, and then this horrible thing involving time dilation happens. And in general, this is the first instance, but definitely not the last, of time dilation playing a really important role in Gunbuster. And time dilation is inherently a fascinating and, like, deeply tragic.
It's, like, probably my favorite. I mean, so a little idea about us. Paul has, like, a very deep background in science fiction.
Correct.
Like, books, shows. I don't.
Mm-hmm.
But time dilation is a sci-fi thing that always just really fucks me up. It's probably my favorite, like, space show plot element of all. Because it's so sad.
Yeah, it's incredibly sad. So they do manage to get off the ship and decelerate in time to be to return to the station by when they were planning to. But in the process of that happening, something happens that I had incorrectly understood up until now, and Molly pointed it out to me, is that Coach asks, as they get out and they're decelerating, Coach asks, how late were we?
Oh, Amano asked Coach.
I'm sorry, Amano asks.
Privately.
I thought Coach asked Amano.
Mm-mm.
Okay.
I don't think so.
Yes, he does. I'm almost positive.
Okay.
Anyway, and she says 12 seconds. And I had always thought that meant that they were 12 seconds late getting off the ship, so it was going to be later than they had planned when they get home. But I think now, rather, it means that if they had gotten to the Luxion 12 seconds earlier by their time, they would have been able to intercept it such that more people would have lived.
Yeah. And it's very obvious why Noriko is not a part of that conversation.
Yes.
Okay, I have a question for you that might be a really stupid question.
Go ahead.
So the very first scene of this episode, when we're in this flashback of the final battle of the Luxion, and it's like Admiral Takaya is watching the video, like he knows he's about to die.
Yeah.
And there's that flash of light.
Yes.
Is that the space monster, or is it, like, Noriko and Amano, like, coming in?
Oh, shit. I had always understood it to be the space monster, but I like your implication way better.
Implication.
Yeah, your much sadder implication much better.
That's what... I didn't think of this the first time I watched the show, but that's what it struck me as.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. I might have to go back and rewatch that scene again, but that's a really interesting implication.
The end of this episode is they board the now completed Excelion, like, to much fanfare.
Right.
And it's been 6 months since everyone has seen them.
Right.
It's like a celebration. Congratulations, welcome home.
Yeah.
And Young comes up to them, very cheery. It's just like, let's, you know, have a party.
Yeah.
To celebrate your homecoming. You know, I'm sorry about your dad.
Yeah.
But like, Genki dashite.
Yeah, like, I'm sorry about your dad, but hey, you know, it's been 6 months for us. It's, you know, whatever. And...
Noriko, like, runs out of the room screaming.
Yeah. And then Amano is like, it's been 6 months for you. It's been like an hour for us.
Yeah. Which is, I don't know. Like, this episode is really heartbreaking.
Yeah.
In a way that it wasn't. It sunk in way more for me.
Yeah, definitely.
This time.
Basically, all of the sort of psychic wounds that Noriko had thought healed, or maybe were healed, because of the death of her dad, like, all of them get, like, ripped back open between the revelation of, like, the true horror of the space monsters, and then, like, you know, literally visiting the site of her father's death, like, in a deeply traumatic way.
And a thing that ran throughout this episode was Noriko talking about how her dad would come home for her birthday. He would always try to be there for her birthday.
Yeah.
And he would go right back to space.
Yeah.
And it was, like, a really important thing for her. And the video that Admiral Takaya watches is her saying, like, please come back for my 8th birthday.
Yeah.
And so the very last scene of this episode is a voiceover from Noriko saying, like, I missed my own birthday this time, but my dad did come back to me.
Which is very sad.
Yeah.
But also good. One of the things that stuck out to me also, just as a side note, is that the music that's playing during the rendezvous with the Luxion scene is a very clear, like, one of the many very obvious homages in science fiction music to the Mars the Bringer of War movement from Gustav Holst's The Planets. That dun 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 thing. That's Mars, baby. I just was like, oh, it's another science fiction thing that makes a more space battle to Mars. It's classic. It's good stuff.
And by the end of this episode, like, the ending song seems so, like, mockingly.
Oh yeah, the super bouncy ending song with all of its pastel, like, slice of life illustrations.
Like, it will get increasingly, like, upsetting.
Yes,
to experience that whiplash.
So that was episode 2. Pretty good.
We're gonna have a lot to talk about in the next one.
Yes, we are.
We're gonna be fucked up.
Yep.
And we look forward to seeing you there.
We'll see you then in a couple of days.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, folks. Why did I say folks?